Welcome, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Chloe Garner. I'm the director of the festival. First of all, I'd like to thank the Arts Council of England, who support the festival. We're very grateful for their support. And I'd also like to thank the sponsor of this event, Mrs. Caroline Beavis, who has very kindly supported this event. So I'm going to introduce our two performers. Alex Knox studied as a singer at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama before switching to the acting programme. His theatre includes Love in Idleness at the West End, The Tempest and Henry V at Shakespeare Rose Theatre. He played Puck in Mendelssohn's A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Barbican Hall. And he also played the war poet, Charles Hamilton Sawley, in It Is Easy to Be Dead. And this play was nominated for an Olivier Award. Alex is the writer in residence with the Cantus Ensemble and has collaborated with them on several immersive concerts, including Path of Miracles and The Ark in the Sky. His play, Ditched, was performed at the Bunker Theatre. And harpist Olivia Jaggers is in demand as a soloist and orchestral player. She freelances with the UK's major orchestras, including the London Philharmonic Orchestra, BBC Symphony Orchestra, Ballet Rombert, the Orchestra of the Age of the Enlightenment. In smaller chamber works, Olivia has recorded for Decca Classics and for Hyperion. She also enjoyed playing in Aldborough Festival and Leeds Lieder Festival and regularly performs at high-profile events such as the Wimbledon Tennis Championships for guests of the Royal Box. But we're really very happy. She's definitely made a good choice by being here with us instead of there. And Olivia has recently been made a Royal Philharmonic Society Enterprise Fund Trailblazer for her weekly online concert series, Harpy Hour. So if that's still going on, check that out. And also, I'd like to mention that Olivia worked with the festival a few years ago with schools, and we've been doing a project which has happened regularly over the years where school children write their own songs. They then compose music, working with a composer, to their songs, and then they performed them here in the community hall. And Olivia and a cellist accompanied the children as they did their songs, which was really wonderful and such a generous thing that Olivia supported that project. So I'm delighted, though, to welcome her back here to Ledbury Poetry Festival in this context. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to our two performers. Mobile phones, please, before we start. I forgot to say, switch off your mobile phones.
Quatuor viae sunt quaeat sanctum Iacobum tendentes, in unum ad pontem regine in ores Hispanise quadonantur. Four roads meet at Puente la Reina in Spain and become one route to Santiago. Some pointers for medieval pilgrims. The language spoken in the Basque country is incomprehensible. The terrain is woody and mountainous, with a serious shortage of bread, wine, and other food supplies. This region has some truly vicious toll collectors. They come at pilgrims with weapons and demand an exorbitant fee. If you refuse to pay, they'll beat you up and take the money, even intrusively frisking you to get it. These people are forest savages. The province of Navarre has plenty of bread, wine, milk, and cattle. But the people's eating and drinking habits are disgusting. The entire family, servant, master, maid, mistress, feed with their hands from one pot in which all the food is mixed together and swill from one cup like pigs or dogs. They are an undeveloped people, malicious, corrupt, and untrustworthy, obsessed with sex and booze. They are badness and nastiness personified. At a place called Lorca flows the river known as the Salt Stream. Be careful not to drink it or water your horse there, because the river is lethal. On its banks, as we were going to Santiago, we found two locals sitting there sharpening their knives. When we asked, they lied and said the water was safe to drink. So we watered our horses, and two died at once, which the men then skinned. After Navarre, the Camino crosses the forest of Oca and continues towards Burgos. This country is full of royal treasure, of gold and silver, flush with bread, wine, fish, milk, and honey. It is, however, lacking in firewood, and the people are evil and vicious. In Galicia, don't eat the fish they call the barbus, or any eel or tench, because without doubt, you will immediately die. There is a river in a wooded place 2 miles from Santiago called Lavacola, in which pilgrims, out of respect for the apostle, wash not only their private parts, but, stripping off their clothes, clean all the dirt from their bodies. The Basilica of Santiago is the length of 53 men. The church has no cracks or defects. It's an extraordinary work. The revered body of St. James lies under the main altar, built in his honour. The whole body of the apostle is here, divinely illuminated by heavenly precious stones. O help for all ages, O honour of the apostles, O bright light of the Galicians, O advocate of the pilgrims, James, supplanter of vices, release the chains of our sins and lead us to the port of safety.
Good afternoon and welcome to this musical trip along the Camino de Santiago, which Alex walked in 2018. and he's going to tell us a little bit about what he just read.
Yeah, that was an extract from the book 5 of the Codex Calixtinus, or the Liber Sancti Jacobi, the Book of St. James, which was compiled, we think, around 1140, probably by a French pilgrim called Amoric Picot. And as well as containing accounts of both sermons and miracles associated with St. James, liturgical text, and the music we just heard there from Olivia, the book can also claim to be kind of the world's, or one of the world's first tourist guidebooks. It's a kind of lonely planet for the Camino de Santiago. The Camino de Santiago is one of the three great Catholic pilgrimages alongside Rome and Jerusalem. And it feels like a good moment to actually ask, is there anyone here who's walked it as well? Fantastic. Buen Camino. Buen Camino. And as well, we have four.
There's two there. Two. One there.
Somewhere. Oh, that's fantastic. We didn't want to presume. Hello. Hi. Is there anyone who's who might be interested in it, or has heard of it, or been curious about it? A few more hands. Great. Is there anyone who's never heard of the Camino de Santiago before today? That's also totally allowed. Thought it might be useful before going any further to give a kind of in our time blurb, digest of exactly what it is and how it came into being. So it really sort of begins, well, could start earlier, but let's start 1,200 years ago when allegedly guided by a heavenly light, a hermit discovered St. James's remains in Galicia, in what's northwest Spain. So at the risk of sounding controversial, he discovered the remains of someone in Galicia, if it really was the apostle St. James, the greater son of Zebedee, to give him his full title. He'd been lying there an awfully long time, for about 800 years. So following his martyrdom in Jerusalem, he was the first of Jesus' apostles to be killed. St. James's followers are meant to have smuggled his body by boat away from Jerusalem and sailed him to Galicia in Spain, where he may or may not have preached in the years following Jesus's crucifixion. Depending on which version of the story you come across, you'll hear that this boat was made of stone and that it sailed without oars or even a rudder and was guided by angels. Once in Spain, there are stories of a band of Galician pursuers plunging to their deaths from a broken bridge, run-ins with a sorceress, even a duel with a dragon. But the thrust of the story is that St. James was laid to rest in this far-flung corner of northwest Spain and lay there for 800 years, long enough for the tomb's location to fall out of memory. But the sudden recovery of this body was authenticated not only by the powers that were, but by a spree of recorded miracles, which was all the proof that contemporary Christians needed, that St. James's body and his relics had indeed been brought to light, which was propitious timing because the Reconquista was in full swing and the Christian forces were only too happy to have an apostolic standard bearer on their side. Stories emerged that St. James divinely appeared on horseback at a battle called the Battle of Clavijo in the 9th century, helping turn the tide of the battle in the Christian favour against the Muslim forces. It earned James the sobriquet Metamoros, or Moor Slayer, and there are still some quite uncomfortable statues all along the route of St. James trampling Muslims, which you can see along the Camino. It's perhaps telling that historians are pretty united in the belief that this battle never took place, the Battle of Clavijo. All this played very well with zealots, and with the heyday of medieval pilgrimage, they think up to a million people, maybe half a million people, slightly more, a year, were travelling to Santiago, and they were travelling with the hope of intercessions, of indulgences, miraculous cures, and one-way tickets to heaven, because travelling there was enough to earn you a plenary indulgence, which had all of your earthly sins absolved. So it was quite a kind of hot ticket from that point of view. But the cult of St. James became a phenomenon, which is perhaps useful for us, because that's pretty much what's happened in the last 30, 40 years, and in 1985, 2,491 lonely pilgrims made the journey to Santiago, and that was the first year they bothered to count people again because they thought it wasn't worth it. But now, fast forward to 2019, 350,000 people made the journey. And they think that now, post-pandemic, we hope, this year is on track to be the most popular year ever. So that's from reports so far. The most popular of the various routes to Santiago, to finish off this little short intro, is the Camino Francés, or the French Camino. Perhaps we can discuss afterwards which routes our audience have travelled as well. But it starts in a little French village called Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port in the French region, the Basque region of France, at the foothills of the Pyrenees. And it's kind of a pilgrim junction because there are four major trails that start in France and they all, well, three of them certainly converge at this point. And it's a kind of holding pen for pilgrims before they make their assault on the Pyrenees.
So I'm going to play a piece by arguably the most famous French composer, Claude Debussy, originally written for the piano. This is also a nod to the Reconquista with the Islamic word of the Islamic art form, arabesque decorative art form. So this is the first arabesque by Claude Debussy.
Thank you.
The idea of virtual pilgrimage became quite mainstream during the pandemic, with the Camino having ground completely to a halt. Many people, having had their plans cancelled, decided to walk the length of the Camino from the relative comfort of their own neighbourhoods. There is an app that you can still download called the Camino de Santiago Virtual Challenge, where you can chart your progress on a map using a street view of the path to show exactly where in Spain you are passing through at that moment. Each time you reach a major destination, you unlock a postcard, which you get sent, and a medal arrives in the post once you reach Santiago. In fact, virtual pilgrimage is really nothing new. In a way, the Stations of the Cross is a kind of virtual pilgrimage in its own right. Believers walking around the church, living through 12 crucial moments, as they believe from the story of the crucifixion. It's very common, particularly in Europe, to see those stations up a steep climb. It's a difficult countdown when you're on a really steep climb. You're thinking, oh, am I only at 5 already? Okay, I've got... But it could be, and indeed was, more virtual still. Pilgrimage, as we heard a little at the beginning, was a really risky business. In fact, if you were going to leave in medieval times, you had to have settled all of your debts before leaving, legally, in order to go, because there was such a high risk of death. Many did die making the journey, and some wealthy pilgrims worried about this even paid others to travel on their behalf. But pilgrimage wasn't possible at all for some people. Strict rules meant, for instance, that nuns couldn't leave the confines of their convents, and so some made virtual pilgrimages by walking around their cloisters, counting the steps required to reach Jerusalem or Rome or Santiago. I recently came across the story of a Portuguese nun, Sister Maria Mintz, who lived sometime in the 14th, 15th centuries, and who made a year-long virtual pilgrimage to the Holy Land. She is meant to have said goodbye to her fellow sisters in the convent, didn't speak or eat with them for the whole year. She completed the distance by walking around the enclosure, stopping to sleep at whatever spot she reached when the bell tolled at night, and waking up in the morning and setting off from that point. She had a guidebook which had pictures and fleshed out in her imagination some of the places she was passing through, which was very common for these nuns making these journeys. At this point, the story takes off in a slightly unexpected direction, because at the end of the 12 months, having reached Jerusalem, Sister Maria prayed before an altar until dawn, and was found the following morning dead. And she had her arms outstretched and her face all aglow with supernatural light. Strips of her habit were cut away and kept as relics by the locals, and claims of miracles were soon associated with these. But sometime after her death, a pilgrim returned from the Holy Land and called at the convent asking for Sister Maria. He said that throughout his pilgrimage, she had accompanied him to many of the holy sites physically, and that while he was on the journey home, she left him, saying that she needed to return to her convent and that he should call there on his way back. And the day of this parting is meant to have been the day she died.
I'm now going to play some music by the most famous medieval nun composer, Hildegard von Bingen. And then I'm going to go into a piece by Lily Boulanger, the younger sister of the more famous Nadia Boulanger. And this is her piece, Dans Jardin Clair. I'm just going to check. No.
Fountains proved to be a surprising feature of the Camino. Many of the albergues, which are a Spanish name for hostels.
We stayed in a lovely albergue last night here in Ledbury. Sue and Graham Woods, thank you so much for having us. The best albergue in town, thank you.
We can definitely recommend. Many of these albergues, and indeed last night, have fountains. And these are often in the patios, the courtyards and the back gardens, but they serve a kind of dual focus and purpose as water features, but much more practically as foot baths. You learn very quickly on the Camino that plunging your feet in cold water at the end of each walking day is the best medicine for tired and swollen feet. And it's not unusual to see half a dozen pilgrims sat on the ledges of these fountains in the late afternoon, usually with a cold beer in hand, letting the water do its magic. There's also a famous miracle associated with St. James and a fountain. A pilgrim dying of thirst was climbing Alto del Perdón, a mountain I think about 10 kilometres outside of Pamplona today, where he knew that there was a natural spring he could reach and drink from. But when he reached the spot, he found that it had dried up. At this moment, the devil appeared and said that he would give the pilgrim water if he renounced God. The pilgrim refused. The devil tempted him again, asking him to renounce the Virgin Mary. Again, the pilgrim refused. Finally, the devil said he would quench the pilgrim's thirst if he renounced St. James. And when the pilgrim refused a third time, St. James arrived on the scene, driving the devil away, and at once a fountain of water began to spring from the ground. The story goes that the pilgrim drank from the apostle's scallop shell, which is his symbol. In more recent times, though, probably the most famous of the Camino's fountains resides 2 kilometres outside Estella in the Navarre region. This Fuente del Vino dispenses free wine to passing pilgrims. I'd assumed there would at least be a supervisor making sure that this too-good-to-be-true highlight of the trip wasn't abused. But no, it proved to be an entirely self-policed fount of free red wine, courtesy of the local monastery and the Bodegas Iraje winery. Some pilgrims were drinking straight out of their hands, others out of scallop shells. I used my water bottle, and for the next couple of days, every sip of water was slightly suffused with a taste of red wine.
I'm going to play now a piece called La Source by the harpist Alphonse Hasselmann. He wrote it in 1884, I believe, and he was also the harp teacher of Lily Boulanger, whose piece we heard just before. Thank you.
So I mentioned earlier Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, which is the spot from where a really large majority of pilgrims begin from, just the other side of the Pyrenees in France. From there you cross the Pyrenees, which is probably the hardest day of walking on the whole trip. And you descend, and on the Spanish side you reach Roncesvalles, where there's a monastery. And from there you pass through Navarre, the Rioja, some excellent wine, of course, Castile and Leon, before reaching Galicia and its capital, Santiago de Compostela. And en route, you pass the major cities of Pamplona, Logroño, Burgos, and León. A remarkable infrastructure has grown up to accommodate all of these pilgrims. Hundreds of albergues and hospices, with small villages transformed into teeming pilgrim pit stops along the way. The entire route is meticulously... there's yellow arrows that are just run the whole way along. Some people arrived without even a guidebook and were able to walk all the way to Santiago. You could just follow the yellow arrows. On the rare occasions they leave room for doubt, often pilgrims have made little arrows out of stones on the floor or written messages in chalk saying, it's okay, 50 yards, and then you turn. But pilgrims, as they go, they carry with them a credencial, it's known as. I've got the one that I used from my walk here, and you're very welcome to come up and have a look afterwards. As you go, you collect stamps to prove that you are walking it. Apparently, for the last 100 kilometres, you have to have two stamps a day because they're slightly worried about, from what I understand, Spanish teenagers cheating, because it's quite good on a CV if you've done the Camino. So people will walk 5 kilometres and catch a bus the rest of the way and get their stamp. So they've insisted on two stamps a day from there on in. But by all means, please come up and have a look afterwards. And they're all very lovely, actually. The stamps are all individual to the place that you pass through. And it's like a kind of access all areas card for a pilgrim. It enables you to get the cheap accommodation, which is often only between 5 and 10 euros a night. But in the middle of the walk, you reach a region called the Meseta, which translates literally as tabletop, I believe. And it is an incredibly flat expanse of land, quite high altitude, and which means it's very exposed in the sun. And with the wind, it blows right across. But it takes about 5 days or so to cross on foot. And you just climb a hill, and suddenly there it is, this ruler straight horizon. And you just walk towards it. And after the Pyrenees and after the foothills through the Rioja, it's quite a shift psychologically to go from a place where you've almost got nothing to look at. And so pilgrims are pretty... certainly the conversations that we had, I had with people... This becomes a much more introspective part of the journey. So the energy until then has been kind of going out, and suddenly it goes in. People tend to walk alone, and some people get a bus the whole way through it, which is completely fine. But for those who do walk it, becomes quite an introspective, quite meditative time. Yes, I'm going to... I'll read just a short extract from a diary, actually, sort of two days in, which I wrote just on the Meseta. With rain threatening, preventatively minded pilgrims were draped in ponchos this morning. Many of these were so voluminous and brightly coloured that their occupants more closely resembled tents than people. Like yesterday, there were morning aches and pains to contend with. The soles of my feet felt like rolled dough, while the skin underneath my big and little toes had been squeezed sideways into white, but so far painless, blisters. Much of yesterday's brunt was absorbed by my knees, and the tendons running down the outsides of them twinged for the first few kilometres. My shoulders were tender, my hips tight, and I had a less than happy left buttock on my hands. But, as I'm beginning to learn, the best remedy for a body stiff from walking is to put it to the very purpose that made it sore in the first place. It's a case of best foot forwards. Slowly but surely, the rhythm of walking, the gentle massaging left, right, ironed out the creases, until within an hour it seemed easier to continue than to stop. My body was recharged. A morning spring entered my step, and I felt my mind clear. I am starting to revel in the simplicity of this new life. There are no time constraints. No one's looking over my shoulder or keeping tabs on me. There are no appointments to be met. And with my phone buried in a side pocket of my rucksack, no emails or WhatsApp feeds are able to vie for my attention. The sole aim of today was to get myself further along the path and to savour what lay along the way. Life has been wonderfully pared back to its basics.
Meditation by Cécile Chaminade.
Now, it almost goes without saying, I think I should say, that many modern-day pilgrims seek out the Camino for non-religious or spiritual reasons. I myself, although I went to Catholic school, feel and still suffer from a lot of Catholic guilt as a result of that. Can't say that I did it for religious reasons, but certainly felt a kind of connection with the historical side of the walk. But lots of people are attracted by the physical challenge. Others come as tourists. I think slow tourism is the phrase that's used often at the moment, which I rather like. There still continues to be a pretty steady throng of devout pilgrims who travel and journey with the intention of deepening their faith. For me, the thing I recognised, if there was one thing that tends to act as a common denominator for pilgrims on the Camino, it's being at turning points in a life. So the Camino seemed to be a magnet for students leaving university, for people in the process of changing careers, retirees seeking out some space to adapt to life after work, those who were grieving. I met someone recently released from prison. There was a lady fresh from an all clear after a very long illness, a man contemplating the priesthood. There are also an unbelievable number of recently heartbroken pilgrims people hoping to walk lovers out of their systems and maybe, just maybe, meet someone better along the way. There are a lot of love stories that I encountered while on the walk. My favourite was probably Rita and Chuba, both from Budapest, although they'd never met before. And they met on the second or third day of the walk, walked for another 6 days, and as Rita said to me, we stayed up talking one night, and then we fell in love. And they walked on together for another 4 or 5 days. Chuba had walked the Camino before, and he was back, this time walking it in stages, so he had a flight home, so they had this very tearful goodbye. Chuba went home, but he acted as Rita's kind of tourist guide from afar, sending advice of places that she should visit along the way and saying, oh, you can't miss this, you can't miss that. About 5 days from the end, before Santiago, Rita was told, well, you can't miss this bar. You've got to visit this bar. So Rita went along and she went into the bar and Chuba was sitting at the back and he'd flown back out to meet her. And she said, we walked hand in hand for the next 5 days all the way to Santiago. They got married 6-7 months ago, and we're still in touch. Just 3 days ago, as it happens, some friends that I made, then Riley and Mary, Riley proposed to Mary. They re-walked, they met doing the Camino, and he proposed to her at the top of Santiago Cathedral. And so they're going to get married in Spain next year. And almost my favourite was the number of Camino babies you met. So these were people whose parents had met walking the Camino a generation ago. And here they are now walking it again. Yes.
I think you'll recognise this one.
Traditionally, a pilgrimage began the moment you set out your front door, and there are those who continue to keep this tradition alive, leaving home and setting off in search of one of the many tributary paths that all lead towards Santiago. While the Camino Francés is the most walked, if you look at a map of pilgrim routes in Europe, you'll see it as part of this kind of enormous, almost London Underground spider's web. There's an extraordinary network. In terms of the Camino and those that converge directly on Santiago, there's the Camino del Norte, which traces the north coast of Spain, the Camino Portugués, which starts in Lisbon and goes via Porto to Santiago, there's the Primitivo from Oviedo, and the Inglés, the English Camino from A Coruña, so named because it was the starting point for many English pilgrims who arrived by boat. At 116 kilometres long, it's probably the shortest of the Caminos. But if it sounds like laziness, although the walk may have been more straightforward, the boat trip, I think, was anything but. I found a 15th century poem by an anonymous pilgrim and poet called The Pilgrim's Sea Voyage and Seasickness. Men may leave all games that sail into St. James, for many a man hit grames when they begin to sail. For when they have take the sea, at Sandwich or at Winchelsea, at Beerstow or where that hit be, their hearts begin to fail. Hail the bowen, now veer the sheet, cook, make ready anoon our meat, our pilgrims have no lust to eat. I pray God, give them rest. Thus meanwhile the pilgrims lie and have their bowls fast them by and cry after hot malady, thou help for to restore. And some would have a salted toast, for they might eat neither sod nor roast. A man might soon pay for their cost as for Ude or Twain. Some lay their books on their knee and rad so long they might not see. Alas! Mine head will cleave on three, thus saith another, certainly. A sack of straw were their right good, for some must lie them in their hood. I had as lief be in the wood without meat or drink, for when that we shall go to bed, the pump was nigh our bedder's head. A man were as good as to be dead as smell thereof the stink. Perhaps the most taxing of all the major routes to Santiago is the Camino Mozarabe, a 1,500-kilometre pilgrim route from the southern port of Almería, established around the 11th century by Christians, Mozarabs, living under Muslim rule. The paths of this route are said to have existed since prehistoric times. Following the Sierra Nevada, pilgrims pass through Granada before joining a larger Camino route called the Via de la Plata, which comes out of Andalusia and crosses the burning heart of Spain.
So now we're going to move to Spanish music. The last piece was La Vie en Rose, if you can think quite of the name. But this is probably the most famous piece of Spanish music that you'd normally hear guitarists play. It's notoriously difficult on guitar. This is a kind of, definitely an adaptation to make it possible on the harp. It's the Recuerdos de la Alhambra by Tárrega.
Thank you.
piece is also originally written for guitar, but I'm playing an arrangement that's been transcribed by the famous jazz harpist, actually Dorothy Ashby, so it goes a little bit off-piste in the middle. And Alex is going to be reading some text over that. So this is the Concerto de Aranjuez by Rodrigo, the Adagio movement, but Dorothy Ashby's version. And the text.
I'm going to read Antonio Machado's Caminante non hay camino, which is probably now the most famous poem associated with the Camino. You may recognise it even in the Spanish. I'll try reading it in the Spanish and then in the English. It's been translated by Mary J. Berg and Dennis Maloney. And just this morning, we were chatting with Finn, who's helping to with the organising of today, and he suggested a poem by Gabriel Garcia Marquez called Travelling Is, which I'll read afterwards as well.
And this is in memory of Finn's friend Will, and it was read at his funeral earlier this year.
Caminante son tus huellas, el camino y nada más. Caminante no hay camino, se hace camino al andar. Al andar se hace el camino y al volver la vista atrás se ve la senda que nunca se ha de volver a pisar. Caminante, no hay camino si no estés en la mar. Traveler, your footprints are the only road, nothing else. Traveler, there is no road. You make your own path as you walk. As you walk, you make your own road. And when you look back, you see the path you will never travel again. Traveler, there is no road. Only a ship's wake on the sea. Travelling is leaving home, parting with friends. It's trying to fly along new routes, crossing paths. It is trying to change. Travelling is dressing crazy. It's saying, I don't care. It's wanting to go back. To return, appreciating the small things, sipping a drink. It's wanting to begin. Travelling is feeling like a poet, writing a card. It's wanting to hug, embracing in a doorway, longing for calm. It's stopping to kiss. Travelling is to become worldly. It's to meet other people. It's to return to the beginning. It's to start offering a hand, learning from the strong. It's to feel solitude. Travelling is leaving home, it's dressing crazy, saying everything and nothing in a postcard. It's sleeping in another bed, it's feeling that time is short. Travelling is to go back. Arriving in Santiago, there are often quite a range of emotions that pilgrims might feel, everything from total anticlimax to complete elation. I arrived after having basically walked through Yorkshire, it felt like, because it rained every day constantly for the whole of the trip, and then arrived. But the final 2 days were in baking sunshine into Santiago. This was, again, a diary entry I wrote the day arriving in Santiago. A Galician bagpiper was playing from the corner of the Praza Obradoiro. It was now 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the square was inundated by a high tide of pilgrims. 50 cyclists, all in matching yellow and blue lycra, were milling on the flagstones a short distance from their bicycles, piled up in a climbing frame of spokes, handlebars and wheels. Hundreds of newly arrived walkers were massed together. Every so often, someone would notice an old friend. There would be shouts and screams across the square and then a lot of embracing. The cathedral became the backdrop for thousands of photographs. There was a stall selling commemorative walking sticks. A mime was dressed up as St. James, and several street artists were selling cartoon caricatures of pilgrims. New pilgrims were arriving all the time. Some simply lay, propped up on their rucksacks, staring at the cathedral. One fell down on his knees and made the sign of the cross. Couples were kissing. "I can't believe we're here," I overheard one woman tell her friend. Another long stream of cyclists rolled in, prompting another round of applause from their friends that rippled its way through the whole square. Several Frenchmen gathered in a circle to sing a rendition of the Ultrea pilgrim song. Maybe more of that in a moment. It was holiday weather. The square was drenched in sunlight and the nearby bars filled up to bursting point. Standard pilgrim attire is among the most brightly coloured on the planet, and the narrow streets that surrounded the cathedral soon resembled technicolour rivers, teeming with the comings and goings of pilgrims dressed in reds, pinks, fluorescent greens and yellows. Lactic was setting into legs and hip joints, and many pilgrims walked slowly and bow-leggedly. Most were pushing through this wall of tiredness and pain with the help of alcohol. But I didn't feel ready to join them yet. There was something compelling about watching pilgrims in the very moment of arrival. When they received their first sight of the cathedral, there was usually a slight give in their shoulders and knees as the air left their bodies. I sat with my back against one of the pillars of the government building that faces the cathedral and saw that the pilgrim sat beside me was weeping uncontrollably, wiping heavy tears from his eyes. The bagpiper continued, but in a higher gear now, and accompanied by a drummer. Thank you.
was a concert fantasy written by the harpist Carlos Salcedo on Lara's theme, Granada.
I mentioned before that there's the pilgrim song, Ultrea, and there might be an opportunity in a moment to do some group learning, if that doesn't sound too daunting. But a little bit about it. The phrase Ultrea, so now mentioned a couple of times in passing, this phrase Buen Camino is the phrase that tends to be shared between pilgrims when they meet on the path. And Buen Camino, Buen Camino. In medieval times, the phrase was more likely to be Ultrea, sort of roughly translating as, I think, onwards, as far as I can understand. And then the answer, reply would be Et Susea, and upwards. So, and this phrase would go back and forth. And there's a pilgrim song that I was taught by various people along the way, including a very enthusiastic nun who had a guitar. She was kind of Maria von Trapp, reincarnated. But the final verse describes the sun setting over Finisterre. And Finisterre, literally, it was a Roman name given to a town in Galicia on the coast. It's about 4 days' walk beyond Santiago de Compostela. It's Fisterra in the local Galician dialect. It literally means end of the world, end of earth. And I think it was largely believed to be the end of the world at that point. And lots of pilgrims, by no means all but some, including myself, walked on those final 4 days. I hadn't intended to at the beginning, but right at the beginning of my walk, with 2 days in, I met a pilgrim called André from Holland, who had set out, he was one of those pilgrims who'd set out from his house. He'd walked all the way from his home in Holland, and he'd left on Easter Sunday, he said. He wasn't particularly religious, but he'd set out on Easter Sunday, and he was hoping to arrive on June 21st on what he called the Summer Solstice. He said he had this plan to arrive on the longest day of the year and have a cold beer, put it in the sand and watch the sun come down on the longest day of the year. This was his plan. And he mentioned this to me, and we kept running into one another. It's one of these extraordinary things that the community seems to do well, chance meetings. You just keep running into people, seemingly at the perfect, most opportune moment. It's funny, but it's something that is held quite strongly by a lot of people as a thing. So, as it happened, for 8 days in a row, André and I ran into each other every single night. Having made no plan, we found ourselves staying at the same place, had a beer together, and we became really good friends. We still are now. Just towards the end of our time together, he said to me about the June 21st plan, "I think you will be there too," he said. I said, "Well, I'm not so sure," because I thought the distances weren't going to quite work out. I thought I'd have to go a bit too fast. But then André changed his plan because he met a lady called Julie, and Julie wasn't going quite as fast as him, so he said he needed to drop behind to spend some time with Julie. So I then felt that I had this kind of, I'd been given this mantle that I had to reach Finisterre on June 21st, and I did. It, in the end, worked out quite nicely. I told a few other people about it, and there was a group of us who were all arriving to reach Finisterre on the 21st, about six or seven of us. And just as we arrived at the end of the walk, I just felt a hand on my shoulder, and it was André, and he said, "I thought I would be seeing you here," he said. But it all worked wonderfully. It had been foggy all day, and about 20 minutes before sunset, the fog cleared and we had a beautiful view. And André had his beer, I joined him, screwed into the sand, and we watched the sunset coming down. But yes, it's this final verse of this song. It's over there at the end of the continent, Saint-Jacques, St. James, is waiting for us with a smile. Fixed smile is the sun that dies in Finisterre, the end of the walk. So, with that in mind, this is the Ultrea song. So, if I sing to you the chorus, we might learn it. It's only three lines, so it should be, I don't want to say straightforward, because that's not fair, because it's in Latin for a start. But the words are Ultrea, Ultrea, et Zusea, Deus adiuvanos. So, Ultrea, Ultrea, et Susea, Deus Adiuvanos. We'll sing it a few times. Bear with us, but I think it would be worth it. I hope.
So here's the tune.
Yeah.
Should we sing that back?
Ultre. Excellent. Should we try it all together? Terrific. I'll sing some verses and we'll come in with that. I think we'll have three goes at singing the chorus.
And this is to close the show, so no pressure, but we need you to be loud.
Tous les matins, nous prenons le chemin. Tous les matins, nous allons plus loin. Jour après jour, la route nous appelle. C'est le bois de Compostelle. Ultra. Terre et chemin de foi, voie millénaire de l'Europe, la voie lactée de Charlemagne, c'est le chemin de tous les jacquets. Ultréa, Ultréa, et Zusea, Deus Adiuvanos. Et tout là-bas, Messire Jacques nous entend depuis toujours son sourire fixe, le soleil qui meurt au Finistère. Ultréa, Ultréa, et Zusea, Deus Adiuvanos. Ultréa. That was wonderful, everyone.